0818-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. Have we got Irene on the line there? We're going to go to Irene in a minute. Well, just to let you know what we want to talk to Irene about, because I brought this up with Shay earlier. Martin Freeman, who you will know, of course, from The Office and The Hobbit, brilliant actor. He's also been a vegetarian. He's been a vegetarian for apparently 38 years, since he was a teenager. But he caused quite a stir yesterday because he turned up on The Dish podcast and announced that he was moving away from vegetarianism because he said he was finding it really difficult to get his hands on unprocessed food. It was the amount of processed food that was on offer for vegetarians was a problem for him. And we can go to, it's not Irene, it's Celia I want to go to, if we have you there now. Celia, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon.
Celia, you're calling from lovely Leitrim, and
I am.
You are a vegetarian yourself?
I am. I'm a nearly vegan.
A nearly vegan.
I've been nearly vegan for about 40 years, and I was vegetarian before that.
Right. Okay, you're going to have to explain what nearly vegan means to us. what do you allow yourself to indulge in that has anything to do with animal produce?
If something had a bit of honey in it, I would probably have it. You know, I don't buy it usually, but if somebody gave me a biscuit that the only animal product was honey, I would probably eat that. I do eat corn products, and they have a bit of free-range egg white in. That's about it, really. Oh, and I have a bit of goat cheese sometimes, but I don't have any cow products. I don't buy eggs, and I obviously don't have meat or fish or any of those things. So yeah, that's basically it.
That's pretty pure, I would say. Now you're very, very close to being able to say pure vegan. And
you're very kind.
why did you decide to not eat meat and dairy and all of that?
Well, I was 40 years ago, when my younger son was a baby and I was breastfeeding him, I became conscious of how awful it must be for the cows when their calves got taken away from them, you know, because I'd heard the cows crying, you know, they make an awful noise when the calves get taken away from them so that people can have the milk. And I kind of thought, I wouldn't like that. And so I decided to stop having cow's milk. And I was already a vegetarian. I already felt sorry for animals being slaughtered and so on. So, but then it went to not having cow products. And then I just kind of went off anything that could involve cruelty, basically, you know. So, because animals have feelings. But then it was years later, after I'd been doing that for years, that I realised the environmental importance as well. You know, they uses far less land to grow food than it does to rear animals to eat. Yeah.
And I mean, you were ahead of your time. Obviously, now not in people vegetarian. You're a wuss if you're only a vegetarian now. In some circles, you have to be all full on vegan. But 40 years ago, it would have been tricky enough to get a vegetarian meal in a restaurant, I would say. Would that be the way?
In the city where I lived then. Back then, I was living in England, and there were vegetarian restaurants, so that was not too. That was all right. I could do that. But I learned as I went along in terms of cooking for myself and my family, you know. But getting back to your caller who went off being vegetarian.
Not our caller, our big star, Martin Freeman. And it's caused, quite the stir. Martin Freeman declaring. Yeah. So is there, because I have noticed, I have to say, and again, we go back to this explosion of interest in veganism. And there's whole aisles now in the supermarket which are devoted whole parts of fridges and supermarkets, chilled sections that are devoted to vegan.
Yeah.
And I have, a lot of it does seem to be like fake meat, kind of pretend meat products. And I wonder if you've gone off meat for all sorts, you know, for reasons like you have, that you don't like animal cruelty, why would you want to eat something that looks and has the same texture as meat, but is actually just highly processed vegetables?
I think I can answer that, actually. It wasn't meat that I disliked. It was what the meat was. As long as I was certain that no animal had suffered, I could still enjoy convincing fake meat, you know. So, which is why I like corn products, the ones that don't have dairy in. You know, they're quite, they do like corn mince and things which don't have any dairy in. But you can get vegan mince, which is very nice as well. But they don't have to. But those aren't ultra processed either, because there's a difference between processed food and ultra processed food, which is obviously bad for you. But then there's meaty ultra processed food that people are eating, and it's making them ill as well. You know,
I did hear a dietitian talking about this recently, actually, and saying that we've all gotten a bit too worried about processed food, and that, you know, in many cases we don't even realize, like, stuff that we would consider not processed is actually processed, but it's fine. But that it's only the ultra processed food that you really need to be careful about.
And I wouldn't want to eat the vegan version of any of that. I mean, most of that stuff is meaty, actually, but I wouldn't want a vegan version of that. But, you know, a lot of the vegan convenience foods are not ultra-processed, and they're fine to eat. And taste, some of them are tasty, some of them are rubbish, actually, but some of them are really nice. I learnt to make vegan meals from scratch, obviously, before any of those were available. And so, you know, I suppose it's time I shared that more with more people, really.
Will you hang on? I want to. Do we have the clip of Martin Freeman talking about? Yeah, can I? Let's just listen to what Martin actually had to say about this. Martin Freeman. This is speaking yesterday on the Dish podcast.
I've come off being a vegetarian. I started being a vegetarian in like January 1986. It's a funny one because I like meat replacement things, but my reservation about them is that they can be very, very processed, and I'm trying to eat less processed food. Yeah. You know?
Celia, will you hang on? Because I want to bring in, we have a few more callers that are coming in on this. Kieran, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
What do you make of what Martin Freeman is saying there, Kieran?
Like all the other stars, you know, they have to shout from the rooftops what they're doing, eating meat, not eating meat, driving an electric car, driving a petrol-driven car, you know. It doesn't matter one iota what he eats, as long as he's kept healthy. Like your previous caller there, from Leitrim, was it? Well, fair play to her. She obviously is healthy with what she eats, the same as I am with what I eat, and I eat a full balanced diet.
And does your full balanced diet include meat?
Oh yeah, definitely. You know.
What do you think about it? Because, I mean, it's obviously not just the big stars, as you say, not the just the Martin Freemans. It's become incredibly popular
What I mean is you see an awful lot of it. Unlike the lady, what was her name there?
Celia.
From Leitrim.
Celia.
Yeah. She's been vegetarian / vegan for 40 years. And fair play to her. But then you get these influencers who are vegan or one thing or the other. That's why we have aisles full of pretend vegan foods.
Well, I think they are actually vegan foods.
Well,
I don't think they're pretending to be vegan.
But you know what I mean? They're pretending to be something else. You know, they're pretending to be burgers or pretending to be meat.
Yeah.
You know? It's like a friend of mine works as a waiter in a hotel in Dublin. And girls came in and one of them announced that she was lactose intolerant and had to have this, that and the other, yet the dessert she had was full of cream and milk and any other dairy product she could put into it, you know. And a lot of these vegans, vegetarians, I think, are the same.
The same as what?
You know, the same as that. They decide because some star has said they're gone vegan or gone meat eating or whatever. So they have to follow suit. Whereas the genuine people are like Celia there, who has her own recipes, her own way of going on, cooks decent food for herself and her family.
But I mean, I know, because I do know somebody who is genuinely lactose intolerant, and it's a really serious issue for them, actually. But they do.
It's a very serious issue. I have friends too who are lactose intolerant, but they won't go along and have a big dessert full of cream.
Well, I know somebody now who would just allow themselves the odd ice cream just because, you know, life is for living kind of thing.
Mm. But they suffer from it, you know.
You basically don't have any truck. You think it's a fad, basically. Is that what you're saying? You're saying it's
not
genuine?
No. I think a lot of it is a fad. There are a lot of genuine people out there, but they are being sidelined by faddy people who have to tell you that they're vegan, or have to tell you that they're vegetarian, or have to tell you that they're not vegan. Do you know what I mean?
Do you not think, though, that it genuinely, particularly the younger, I mean, the teenagers and millennials and, you know, the younger Gen Z and all that, that they are more aware of the impact that meat might be having on the environment, and that they are genuinely trying to do their bit.
The food that they eat has a bigger impact on the environment than the cows. They have to fly it all around the world. Half the stuff that they eat you cannot get in Ireland or Britain. It's not indigenous. Yet if, like me, you get local produce, even the rapeseed oil I use is made in Donegal, just up the road from me. You know, and Celia isn't causing any air miles with her food. Apart from the odd bit, you know, the same as myself, like you can't get olive oil here, you know.
Okay.
But like if they're thinking about the environment, they should think about buying stuff local, growing stuff themselves. They have balconies, they can put window boxes up, they can grow their own herbs. They don't have to go and get a glass bottle full of herbs that cost them 3 or 4 euro when they just go out to the balcony and snip a bit.
Do you try and do that to you know, that whole 5 kilometre that you do, you know, from food to fork, from field to fork?
Yeah, I do. I do indeed.
Okay, but Kieran, will you stay there for me? Because I've got, I want to bring in Sabine. Sabine, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Kitty.
You are also vegetarian, almost, just like Celia, almost vegan, you say, yeah?
Pretty much vegan, yes. We have the odd scone, and if we're out and about, it might be with butter rather than margarine or something. But yes, no. Normally, we eat what I would call a whole food plant-based diet.
Okay, you're not. Is that a German tinge to your accent, I hear?
It is indeed, yes. But I've been in Ireland for more than half my life, so I'm nearly here now. I moved here in 1995. So
all right, okay.
You're here quite a bit.
Are you still considered a blow-in, Sabine?
I live in Skerries.
Right.
My children's children will be blow-ins, so yeah.
So you are, as you say, 1995. And what did you make out of what Martin Freeman said yesterday?
It's a bit silly. If you want to eat vegetarian or vegan, there is no need to eat bad food. And you make your own choices. Maybe he's out in restaurants a lot. And it is true that a lot of the meals that are now vegan, vegetarian in restaurants are nearly always, a lot of them are based on meat replacements, on plant protein based. And that's not very healthy. I agree with that. But you can eat very healthily and very tastily a vegetarian or vegan diet if you so choose. And if you don't want to do that, then it's not like coming off being vegetarian. It's just now and again eating something that isn't plant-based.
I think a lot of people would go along with vegetarians. I think a lot of people are doing the meat-free Mondays and, you know, going halfway house, even if they're not gone fully vegetarian. But I think vegan, for a lot of people, is that's a tough extra step. in terms of figuring out how to cook without, without cheeses, without
cheese,
dairy.
Yeah. I'd say cheese was a hard one to replace. Now, milk is easy. You know, you get lovely yogurts made on soy. You get lovely oat milk, including Irish. And I used to always go for the organic milk, and now I go for the organic oat milk that you can get in the supermarket. So that's fine. And I actually like the taste better now of a good oat milk cappuccino. I think is for me nicer than a milk one.
It tastes lovely, but you're not getting your protein there, though, are you? There's no protein in oat milk, as far as I know.
We actually have because we don't eat meat replacement. Usually, we eat lots of beans and chickpeas, that kind of thing. We try and get a lot of you have your nuts and everything, so we're fine for protein, really. I don't think that having milk in your tea makes up for the protein, really, or in your coffee.
No, but I'm just saying, in general, you have to keep an eye out for the replacements that you're using, that they don't actually replace some of the nutrients that you are foregoing when you don't do dairy. In terms of cheese, I am kind of fascinated when I see vegan cheeses on the thing. Do they taste like cheese?
No. it depends on what you call cheese. You know, if you go for the worst cheddar, then yes, you probably get an okay comparison by buying, you know. But very rarely I will have some real cheese, and then I enjoy it. But I mean, we're talking once or twice a year, and otherwise I can live without it. It's cheese, it's also a health thing with us. We went on a vegan plant-based cookery course, which was offered online here in Ireland in 2018 for 1 month. Mm-hmm. And then we stuck to it like religiously for the month. And that was going from eating meat and dairy to nothing. And that was quite a change. But because we had this course and we had the recipes from it, it was excellent. There was a lot of videos also on the nutritional side of it, and, you know, sources, how to make sure you get everything that you need, what have you.
So Sabine,
and my husband's cholesterol went down so far. It's like he went from being really bad to really good. So, yeah.
That's sorry to talk obviously, but are you saying you were both eating meat up until 2018?
Yeah, and I wasn't going to give it up, really. I mean, out of the family of three, I was the one going, why would I give up meat and dairy? And then when I tried it, I actually really liked it. And because it was important health-wise for my husband and to a certain extent to my son, who turned out to be actually allergic to eggs. He's kind of eating a pretty normal mixed diet now. He's living away from home. But it's great for him that vegan food is labeled vegan so much now, because he can go for it and knows there's no eggs in it, for a different reason, of course.
And what do you miss from? I know you said cheese was one thing that you would, and I have to say I would definitely miss cheese if I was to go down that route. Like bacon, people say, frying bacon is the one thing.
I keep forgetting one thing. I'm a bad vegan. I eat honey. You're not supposed to have honey if you're like true dyed-in-the-wool vegan. But
you'd be thrown out of the vegan club now, Sabine.
If there was a club, yes. But I basically do it for health reasons, and I don't see any reason for that. I think the most, especially if you go for organic honey, they treat the bees slightly better than some of the more industrial honey producers. And
just to be clear, is that why the honey is it, that there is an issue about bee welfare?
I think so. I mean, they're given sugar water instead of honey for themselves. And, you know, some of the beekeepers have gone to actually giving them some of the honey back, which I think is a nice thing. But, I don't really understand bees well enough to fully go with that.
Okay, but you're not missing the meat.
No. I certainly do not miss the meat or the chickens or anything, no.
Wow.
No.
I've got, thanks for that, Sabine. I want to bring in Lucy. Lucy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Casey.
What do you think about this processed vegan food that Martin Freeman took issue with?
I'm very much in with Sabine there. I don't eat processed food either. I've been vegan for about 6 years, And
why did you go down that route, Lucy?
Animal welfare. Yeah, so I'm kind of with the lifestyle approach of just avoiding suffering for animals. Once you kind of go down it, you keep hearing people talking about cheese, but actually, when you look at the issues of cows, dairy cows, and the way that their babies are taken away from them, often unweaned, sent abroad, the live export industry, and you suddenly realize that actually, it's just not worth having their product. And plus, we shouldn't, as a human being, shouldn't be drinking the milk of another animal once we're weaned ourselves. So I loved cheese myself. My husband used to, like, you know, we sat down and we'd have a block of cheese. It was kind of like, you know, we just had too much of it. And so it's very easy for me with the animal welfare thing. But also, again, my health was really improved. I had very high cholesterol as well. And essentially, once I started looking at it from the cruelty side and then seeing the cheese is essentially fat and salt, it wasn't difficult for me to make that decision. So, you know,
okay,
yeah.
So talk me through your diet then a little bit, Lucy. What would be a typical breakfast?
I tend to not to have breakfast. I do the intermittent fasting. So I start my day with a big mug of hot water with lemon in it. And then at about 11:30, after I come back from walking the dog, I'll have like a big vegetable smoothie. My husband makes one for himself because he was very ill a few years ago with pancreatitis. And so he had to change his diet completely as well. And he just kind of opens up the bottom of the fridge and whatever's in there, he chucks into a big smoothie. And that's what I have when I come back around 11:30. My son, I'm very lucky today. My son has just landed in front of me. I just finished eating it. Some gorgeous sourdough bread, which is from the spelt maker in Kilkenny, topped with mushrooms, which were grown in Offaly, topped with parsley, which I went and got out of the garden in a kind of a lovely creamy sauce. So that was my lunch. Haven't decided what we're going to have for dinner tonight. The bottom of the fridge is full of vegetables because I've just been to the market. And obviously I've got peas and legumes and chickpeas and all that to make sure we all get our protein. So yeah, I cook nearly every day. I make lots of hummus. Make soups, smoothies. I normally have a big salad at lunchtime. I put every seed and nut in it as well, and splash of a big dollop of hummus or whatever's around. Or we made wild garlic pesto recently, which we foraged from locally. And yeah, I mean the amount of foods that are available to us are huge. So yeah.
Do you find you eat a lot more raw food, as in like salads? And
yeah, I try to include a lot of raw because obviously in raw food the enzymes are intact, so it makes it much easier for your body to digest the food. So you know, when we cook our foods, we cook the nutrients out of them, we cook the vitamins out of them, and we cook the enzymes out of them. So yeah, I would have my diet, I would say, would be maybe 60-40 raw, as much as I can. I'd like to do more raw, but I do the odd raw chili and the odd raw curry as well, and they go down very well, amazingly. I've tried them out in my family, and they've gone, that's nice.
A raw curry. How do you make a raw curry?
Well, I would make, say, a creamy sauce with probably a nut base, like a cashew nut cream or something like that. And then chop up and add loads of spices to it, puree it, make it into a nice creamy sauce. And then I would just chop up whatever vegetables in the bottom of the fridge, peppers, cauliflower, some spinach, something like that. And then just mix them, marinate them and leave them, and then have them with hot rice. So the curry's cold, but the rice is hot. But you can warm it up to a certain temperature as well, and it's absolutely gorgeous.
It does sound quite good, actually, Lucy.
Oh, it's so good, Katie. You would be amazed. It's really good.
You know what you said, the dairy, and obviously there's that issue about weaning calves early,
yeah,
and all that. But I mean, obviously not every dairy farm or not every farm works like that. The suckler farms where the calves are left with their
dairy,
mothers.
But dairy, unfortunately, yeah, it's very few though. Yeah. I mean, we send something like 200,000 calves abroad every year, those little male calves. In their thousands. I mean, we've all seen the RT investigates programs about the cruelty involved in it. We have
dairy,
no idea what happened.
Dairy's dirty secret,
end.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, exactly. It's shocking, and it's been going on. I mean, I remember even being down at the docks in Cork with my mum when I was a child, you know, in the 70s, and seeing it then. And it stopped for a number of years, and, you know, it's bigger now than it ever was. And the cruelty involved is just awful.
What about goat's milk? Because, I mean, I don't think there's any industrial kind of level farming of goats for dairy in
No, there isn't. But again, if you think about it, no one eats goats in this country. So that means that any male goat that's born is going to be killed immediately. So, you know, they're just, I don't even know if they go to processing factories. I don't know that they just slit their throats on the farms. I mean, I know we have to do that with some of the calves as well. I think it was over 20,000 calves were killed on farms last year. There's just too many of them. And so goats, obviously, very similar thing will happen. Male people don't eat goat in this country, and so male goats will
But
be
if you had a goat, as we had when we were kids, if you had a goat just in the back garden, basically, and you just took the milk from that goat and, you know, lovingly had that goat and minded that goat, what would be the harm in that?
Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? Well, first of all, we don't need it. You know, again, like, we're an animal that needs milk when we're a baby. And that milk, essentially, if at all possible, should be the milk of our mother. Same with every animal. And there is no need to go and start taking milk from the udders of another animal. It's a bizarre thought when you think about it. That milk is designed to grow a kid into a full-sized goat, and for a calf, to grow that calf, which is a very big animal. So it's got to have very high in growth hormones and protein specifically for that species. And we're drinking the species of another milk once we've been weaned. It's a very, very odd thing when you think about it. So it's not so much that we're lactose intolerant either. It's just we're not designed to drink the milk of another animal once, you know, at all, and definitely not once we've been weaned. So we don't need it. So taking the milk, I mean, obviously, as we all know, an animal can only have milk, the mother, if she produces a baby. So she has to be impregnated, obviously, we know, within the industry, because it's on a huge scale. Having a goat in your back garden, now you wouldn't have much of a back garden if you had a goat, but obviously, that would be a smaller scale, but it's impractical, and we don't need it. And, you know, people can't just have a goat in their back garden.
Well, I mean, whether we need it or not, an awful lot of people do love it, though, Lucy. There's no two ways about it. I'm told, and this I've just gotten this in, Ireland has the lowest level of lactose intolerance in the world. I'm not sure.
It's probably true because we've been drinking cow's milk for so long, because the industry have fooled us into thinking that we need cow's milk. The NDC are very, very good at telling people that they need it for their bones and their teeth and all the rest of it. And it's actually not true at all. And we have the dairy industry, I mean, obviously the formula milk industry is huge. It's the most lucrative part of the dairy industry. We send billions of tons of breast milk substitutes to Asia and to Africa. And that's probably the most lucrative part of the industry. So, you know, we've missed a couple of generations of breastfeeding in Ireland, with mothers thinking that formula was as good, if not superior, to their own milk. So, you know, there's that issue as well. So we have adapted the body.
I don't know if we can blame farmers for the low levels of breastfeeding over the last couple of generations.
I'm not blaming farmers. It's a system. It's a very bad system. I mean, farmers, I know, I have friends in Kilkenny who are dairy farmers, and they were encouraged.
You must have some very lively conversations. Lucy.
We do. Okay. Indeed, I do.
I'm going to have to bring in, I have a couple of more calls waiting, Lucy. Thank you for that. Brendan. Brendan, good
Hello.
Afternoon. How are you?
Oh, I am grand, thanks.
You're also, you're not vegan, you're vegetarian, is that right?
Oh, I'm vegetarian. I'm an organic raw vegetarian.
Okay. What is that? So you don't cook your food at all, or...?
No, I'm just terrified at point of this and that woman that was on earlier with you about I'm 94% raw. The only thing I cook is my porridge. I get organic porridge from Kilbegan. I cook that in the morning, and I cook my fish, fresh fish. That's the only thing I
cook.
That's the only thing I cook, and the rest is all raw.
And why is that?
And I became vegetarian in 2014, And my nephew, he's on organic, where I was born in Ballinasloe. They started an organic farm, and from watching the healthy vegetables coming through when they were in the packing shed and all that, it impressed me very much. Anyway, I was always into gardening. My father was the head gardener in the mental hospital in Ballinasloe for many years, so I had gardening in my blood from the start.
And do you grow everything you eat now yourself?
Most of it myself. Anything that I'm stuck, I get from Beechon Organic now and again. At the moment now, for instance, I've been eating for the past month, 5 weeks. I've been eating kale, purple and green kale, spinach, some lettuce, chard, that kind of thing. That's just now, and like that's early in the season. There'll be other vegetables coming in through later on. But I grow and eat my own, and I'm living here in Ballinasloe in a small cottage in the town, and I have a front and back garden, very small area, as I can tell you, and I grow and eat everything in there, and that's what I believe in today's society. The people are talking there about processed food and all that and everything. If people get off their backside and go out and grow their own. It's very simple to grow your own food now. You don't need any parts, anything at all. I have grow rings. I use grow rings that I got from two lectures up in Sligo IT going back about 10, 12 years ago. And they're the people who developed these grow rings. And anybody can use them. But anyway, that's a long story short.
Brendan... that's the message from you anyway, Brendan. Get off your backside and grow your own food. But I suppose you do have to have some bit of ground to do that in, even with the grow rings. Thanks for that, Brendan. We have to take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I want to go to Patricia now. Patricia, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Katie.
Patricia, I just want we're not talking to you about veganism or vegetarianism.
Totally different.
You have a story that will put the heart crossways on the country, I think, when they hear what happened to you less than a couple of weeks ago now.
About 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
Take us back to that night.
I'll explain it. Yeah, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. So I have a Revolut account, which I normally use for small transactions. And I top it up with my OnPost current account, which is the debit card linked to it. And on the morning, about 1 o'clock in the morning, I just still happened to be awake. I could have been asleep. But that morning, I received two emails from Revolut. The first email was to confirm that I had updated my email address. And then the second one came in and said that I had added an automatic top up of €4,000 to my Revolut account from my OnPost current account, which is again the card I have linked to it for top ups.
Okay.
Now I hadn't requested either. I hadn't clicked on any link, and I tried to get into the Revolut app. I was locked out.
Just to take it slowly with us, Patricia.
Yeah.
There was actually a link to click on in this email, but you, listening to all the advice we're worn out hearing now, you didn't click on anything.
There was no link. The email just came in and gave my name, and it said, this is just to confirm that you have set up an automatic top up to your Revolut account from, and then the name of my account. So I hadn't done that. I closed the email. I tried to get into my Revolut app to see had money gone out of it, but I was locked out.
Okay.
I wasn't even holding my phone. I was doing nothing. I was getting ready for bed, but I heard the two emails come through and I opened them up.
And the first one said you had changed your email account, and you had never changed your email account either.
No. No. And the second email said that I had just, in the last few minutes, added an automatic top-up from my current account to my Revolut account.
Okay, so you're there now and you are panicking, obviously, as we would all be in that situation. And these, and just to say, these were these were genuine emails from Revolut informing you of activity.
Oh, they were genuine from Revolut. Yes, informing they were genuine. Yeah.
But you didn't know that.
Yes, of the activity.
And you were nervous.
I didn't do either. Yeah. I had made neither transaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't done anything.
Okay, so what happened next?
Well, then I got onto Unpost, the phone number, and they said they would freeze the card for me and logged into Unpost and saw that €4,000 was in fact transferred from it to Revolut. And I couldn't get into Revolut still, but I could see in my Unpost current account that the automatic top-up had taken place and it had left my account. So thankfully, because I was awake at that time in the morning, I was able to freeze my card and no more money came out of my account. But had I been asleep, my account would have been emptied.
And I don't want
and
to
so
know exactly
far, a little over
I don't want to know exactly what was in that account, but there was reason that there was more money in that account than might be.
Oh yeah, there was. Yeah, and it would have all been gone because the automatic top up had been established and it was working. I hadn't set it up, and it was working, and my account was sending €4,000 to Revolut, and it was being taken out by the hackers. And since then, Revolut have confirmed that a scam has taken place, a very sophisticated scam.
Okay, so there was a little inheritance of money in that account, and you also had money in that account for other purposes that you wanted to pay.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So there was more money there that could have ended up in these criminals' hands.
I know it would have. Yeah. If I hadn't have been awake at 1 o'clock in the morning and read the emails and immediately got onto Unpost and got my car frozen, the account would have been emptied because every time it was taken out of Revolut, Revolut would have topped up again, 4,000, taken out, topped up again, and they would have drained and emptied my account.
And that would have been your entire life savings.
Next morning.
That would be your
That was everything. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So a lot of money has already gone. And I have tried to contact Revolut. They have no phone number here. You cannot speak to anybody. I have written emails. I've had no reply. And I've tried to contact Unpost, and it's more or less the same situation. So since this happened, I have not been able to speak to anybody from Unpost or from Revolut. So I was just wondering, has this happened to any other listeners?
I think just
a warning to them.
Just to say, and just to be clear, because we don't want to put anybody off, that you did eventually speak to somebody in Unpost, I understand, did you?
Yes. Yeah, yesterday. But I think maybe it could have been because they got something from Liveline. So I did get a call yesterday evening from Unpost. And they said as of from yesterday, they're investigating it. But it actually happened on the 19th of April, so it should have already been investigated.
Okay.
And they're investigating from yesterday.
As you say, our team here, Tara here, has been on to both Revolut and Unpost about this case.
Yes, she has.
And again, the most important thing to impress upon people, because we have so often had people, and I've had them on Liveline before, feeling, you know, very, very, you know, unfortunate that they were persuaded to click on something or they were persuaded to give information over the phone.
Yeah.
Nothing. You did absolutely
nothing.
No information away.
No, I was at home. I was minding my little grandson, and probably that's because I wasn't really asleep when I have my, I tend to be up later and just watching him. And I had gone in to check on him, went in, I was getting ready for bed, and I heard two emails come through on my phone, and sometimes I might have opened them, other times I wouldn't, but I did open them this time. And thank God I opened them this time, because that's what was going on in my account. The money was going from Unpost into Revolut and being taken out through Revolut.
Okay, just to say,
the two emails.
Sorry, Patricia, I just wanted
Yeah.
I just wanted to give listeners an idea of what Revolut are saying in relation to this. They say, we are sorry to hear of this case and any instance where our customers have been targeted by ruthless and sophisticated criminals. They say each potential fraud case concerning a Revolut customer is carefully investigated and assessed independently of other cases. Our investigation into, and they have your name or your case, remains ongoing. So they say they are currently investigating your case. If customers think that they have fallen victim to a scam, we advise them to contact Revolut customer support via our secure chat, where we can be reached even if a customer's account has been locked. And they say that Revolut takes fraud and the industry-wide risk of customers being coerced by organised criminals incredibly seriously. They say they have robust protections in place for their millions of customers, and they analyse over 500 million transactions a month. That's what Revolut are saying. On Post are saying that... Yeah. Post is fully aware of this customer's issue and we're working with her to resolve it. We do not comment on any customer's personal accounts, and they say they have a range of specialist teams and procedures for dealing with fraud prevention and investigation. You also went to the guards, Patricia, did you?
I did, yeah, because I know on Post are investigating it, but the first I heard of them investigating it was yesterday. A lady phoned me from on Post and she told me, but before that, I have probably emailed them several times and tried to call them through their customer service number. They told me in customer service I couldn't speak to fraud. Fraud claimed that I had verified it, which I haven't, and that's all I got from them. Nobody rang me to talk to me about it, and the same from Revolut, and they're probably looking into it now because Liveline have been in contact with them.
Yes, well, they are. They say they are looking into it and they're working to resolve it. They say, as are now Revolut are saying that, and I know, as you say, with the guards, and the guards also referred us to a statement that they put out just to how to avoid this, because this is what people out there today, I'm sure, are thinking right this minute. How do I stop this kind of thing happening to me? But this is a particular kind of fraud, account takeover fraud. They're saying be wary of texts, especially if you were expecting a delivery. And of course, that's not how they got into your account. Be wary of cold calls. Always ask the caller their name and for their phone number. If you have any concerns, just hang up and ring your bank or service provider yourself. Don't download any apps that give fraudsters control of your device. Never click on any links. Never give away your personal data. Do not transfer any money. Get advice from a trusted person before taking any action. Of course, Patricia didn't do any of those things, but unfortunately, she is still €4,000 down, and she's waiting to hear back from that. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And as I said, definitely a story there that would put the heart crossways on all of us. That you even if you're as completely smart and not doing anything at all, you can still find yourself in that position. I want to move on now because this is an amazing story. Stephen, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you doing?
I just love this story. This is a story about your uncle, Paul Hogan.
It is indeed, Katie. Yes.
He stole a painting, Stephen.
He did. He did. He never quite saw it in terms of theft. He saw it, I think he called it an act of restitution. That's what he referred to it as.
Okay, we better tell people the backstory to this then. This is a painting that was part of a collection that was being put together by Hugh Lane. And of course, people will know the Hugh Lane Gallery, fabulous gallery in Dublin.
Exactly.
Beautiful,
exactly.
Incredible collection of Impressionist paintings.
Yes.
And he was gathering this, and the plan always was that there would be a gallery, that these would be on display in Dublin for the Irish people.
Correct. Yeah. So a bit about Lane. Lane was born in Cork in 1879 to modest means. His dad was a rector, an only child, left the UK and really kind of invented himself and became the preeminent dealer of British and kind of international art, and discovered Impressionism around about 1904, and he was Augusta Gregory, Lady Gregory's nephew, and through that connection and time at, you know, Coole Park, he met Yeats and became immersed in the what was described as the Irish cultural revival, and saw Ireland as somewhere that could benefit greatly from his growing collection of French Impressionist art. He was an incredibly successful dealer, and he was a kind of superstar dealer, lived very modestly, although people kind of saw him as a kind of Medici figure. He was absolutely committed to the idea of modern art in Dublin, and he set up in 1908 the first dedicated Museum of Modern Art, the Municipal Gallery of Modern Art, and that was set up on Harcourt Street. And he wanted to, he saw that there was an opportunity to really bring modern art to Ireland at a time when he felt, you know, the country could benefit greatly from the freedom, the beauty, and the spirit of modernism. And he was kind of given short shrift down the line. There was a whiff of licentiousness, of kind of anti-Catholic, you know, excess in these pictures. So he didn't get great support from Dublin Corporation. And what his offer was, if you can build a specific space, a gallery for these pictures, I will give them to you. And the upshot was essentially Dublin Corporation refused. And in a fit of pique, he said, okay, feck yous all, I'm going to give these pictures to the National Gallery in London. And by this time, 1914, he became the first director of the National Gallery in Ireland, and again was giving extraordinary pictures of his own personal collection to the National Gallery of Ireland. And he, during the war, he was going through some quite difficult times, but he made a deal. He sold a Holbein and a Renoir to an American billionaire, and to do that deal, he had to go to the States. Now, the First World War had started, and he had to go over there and do this deal. And he had a premonition of some kind, because his current will at the time had given those pictures to the National Gallery in London. But the intention was always to give them to the people of Dublin.
Now, so hang on a second. Well. Oh, yeah, I was going to say, how do we know that?
Yeah. Because he was talking about it all the time. And he had made it clear that it was a fit of pique that he gave the pictures to the National Gallery in London. So he changed his will. The pictures are to go as planned to the people of Dublin, provided a space can be provided. And then we all know what happened. He was on the Lusitania, on the way back, torpedoed and drowned. Now, when this codicil, this change to the will, was discovered, the National Gallery in London said, well, it wasn't witnessed. You know, it's not legal. We're not having any of it. And anyway, you don't have a space for these pictures, and they'd be kind of lost on you anyway. You're not really interested in modern art. It's not for you.
And at this stage, how many paintings are in the Tate at this stage?
The National Gallery, 39 pictures. The what was known as the Continent, which was 39 pictures. Now, among those pictures were eight kind of rock star images by Manet, Renoir, Pizarro, like iconic. Yeah. Pictures of French Impressionism. So they hang on to them, and that's when the kind of the bleeding sore of the injustice, you know, becomes apparent to one and all. And over the years, many attempts were made to get the pictures back. The Hugh Lane Gallery was opened in 1936, and throughout that period, there was an empty space there, symbolically kept empty for, at some point, the hoped-for return of these pictures, which never came. And this went on.
That was a political act, was it? The leaving the blank space.
It was Dublin finally got their act together and said, right, we're going to make a gallery specifically, as per the will, the Municipal Gallery of Dublin Art. We're going to call it the Hugh Lane Gallery, and we hope and expect that these pictures, at some point down the line, will be returned. And there was huge debates, and there was a lot of, you know, it was a huge story at the time for many years, led by Lady Gregory, who was campaigning. You know, it was really her kind of the end of her, the second half of her life was dedicated to trying to get, you know, her nephew's pictures back to Dublin. And it never happened. So Paul, who was an art student at the time, heard about this and felt this was, you know, a very grave injustice. It was a clear kind of breach of trust. You know, soldiers dying in the First World War didn't have to have their wills witnessed. In Scotland, you don't need codicils. But the British authorities insisted that they were sticking to the letter of the law. And despite Will's, Lane's stated aim to have these pictures go back, they ignored it. And that was the state of affairs when Paul and his pal, Billy Fogarty, decided to do something about it. Now, you have to remember that in Ireland in the 50s, it was a very, you know, dynamic period for student activism. You know, there was a whole new generation. Rock and roll had happened. You know, Rebel Without a Call was out. Elvis had his first album. You know, it was a time of change. It was an exciting change. And there were huge protests about the Suez Canal and, you know, marches in Nelson's Pillar. So this was a plan that was devised by Paul and Billy, and with the support of the National Students' Council of Ireland, to go over there and take direct action. So the plan was to have a photographer outside the Tate. They went over to London to the photographer would capture the event. Paul had kind of concocted a letter of introduction to the director of the Tate, because he was an art student, and art students were allowed to go to galleries and copy pictures. It was kind of part of their training. And he was welcomed in. They scoped out the gallery, worked out, you know, when the guards would be in the galleries and, you know, when the right time would be. And they never expected to get away with it. All they wanted to do was to get somehow get the picture off the wall if they could, get the picture on steps of the Tate, have the picture taken with them being wrestled to the ground, you know, by the authorities. They might spend a few days in jail, and, you know, the story would be made. That was the plan.
Right. But, and I just to say, I'm looking, and we put it out, we put it on the Liveline account. The most magnificent photograph of Paul.
It's wonderful. Yeah, that photographer, Charlie Carter, got the best news photograph of the year, of that year. So the story. So
just to explain to people, this is Paul. This is your uncle Paul
at the bottom of the steps with Billy in the background, yes. Foot in the door, to stop anyone coming out after. And what the picture is in his artist's portfolio, his student portfolio,
basically,
going down the steps under his oxter, and Billy saw the photographer. The photographer was told to turn up for a student protest. There was no student protest. There was nothing going on. And he saw this character coming down, and Billy shouted, "Take the picture." And he took the picture. He took one frame, and he went off back to the office. And then, astonishingly, Paul was challenged as he left by an attendant. And he said, "Oh, it's all arranged. And the attendant just let him sail through. And there he was on the bottom of the steps of the Tate, not knowing London. They'd never been before. And the only thing he could think of doing was to jump in a taxi and say the only place he knew offhand, which was Piccadilly Circus. So the taxi took him to Piccadilly Circus picture under his arm.
Yeah, but, I mean, this is not a small thing. This is a fairly substantial sized painting that he's now carrying.
Exactly. He's burdened with this picture, the value of which, by the way, now is about 10 million euros. At the time it was 50,000 pounds, but now it's worth about 10 million euros. They went on the run then. The picture was developed. The Metropolitan Police were called in. And fascinatingly, the guy they put in charge, DCI McGrath, was a Dubliner. And he had led the case for to get the Stone of Scone, the Scottish student protest that happened 4 years earlier. So he was the guy for Art House, and he was a Dubliner. And again, this story reflects so much of the Irish experience in the UK, where so many Irish people would have joined the mess and, you know, became part of English life. And this guy, you know, set about trying to track them down. So there was an all ports and airports notice put out. The picture made world headlines. It even put off Grace Kelly Grace Kelly's marriage to Renier, you know, and it was everywhere. It was world news, this guy coming down the steps with the picture under his arm. But then they were in London with the picture, and what to do? What did they do? Would they try and get the picture back to Dublin? And so they kind of went on the run. And it's an extraordinary tale of, you know, literally the cops turning up in the Mark 6 Jags, you know, in little hotels and little pubs.
And of course, by now, Paul's got a very famous face because it's been published everywhere.
He was tracked down. He was tracked down. And you know, the hilarity of it is that they went to Cambridge and they decided that the best thing to do was to disguise themselves as priests, because there was a lot of priests in Cambridge. So, you know, there they were marching around as priests, and the landlady would kind of suddenly recognize them, you know, from the news that was all over the place, you know, and call the cops, and the cops would turn up and they'd just get away. And so this went on for 4 whole days. And they realized there was no way they could get the picture back to Ireland. And they thought, what we'll do is, symbolically, if we can get it back on Irish soil, at least the gesture will have been made. So they got a friend. Paul had met a girl called Mary, who was a fascinating character in her own right, an Irish girl. And she dropped the picture off to the Irish embassy in London, who promptly returned it to the Tate. And there's a great picture, you know, not wanting to rock the boat. There's a great picture of the gallery, the director of the National Gallery, receiving the picture back from the Irish ambassador. But the point had been made, and the hilarious thing is that we discovered, the Independent in London discovered the account of this that had been in the police files of this, which were in the National Archive in Kew. And they knew who Paul, they had found out who Billy and Paul were, but the decision was made not to prosecute them because they didn't want to make martyrs of them, because they knew it wasn't for personal gain, but it was a political act. And also, it showed how desperately bad the security of the pictures was.
I was just going to say, I can see another reason why you wouldn't be advertising this very, very...
Exactly. Exactly. So they decided to let them go, but hilariously, so they got the boat back, and Paul's dad had a call from McGrath saying, you know, your boy is on the boat, on the ferry from Liverpool, you know, we're not going to prosecute, but he can't come back, which was hilarious.
So the thing is, these paintings are still in the Tate now, and I was saying earlier, these are our Elgin marbles, really, aren't they?
They are absolutely our Elgin marbles. And what the current arrangement is, pictures are still owned by the Tate and the National Gallery in London, but they have reached an agreement to have a long-term loan for 27 of them in Dublin, 2 of them permanently in London, but the 10 kind of rock star images, like, you know, the Manets, the Renoirs, etc., are alternated every 5 years. They're loaned to Ireland every 5 years, and every 5 years they go back. So there's 2 groups of 5, and they switch over. So currently the picture that Paul took, the Berthe Morisot, the Jour d'été, the summer's day, is on display in London. So it's a legal fudge that doesn't in any way represent the true intention of Lane to have these pictures owned by the people of Dublin in a municipal gallery of modern art. And yeah, you can say it's the realpolitik of Anglo-Irish relations where we'd agree to share it, but it is another kind of breach of trust, you know, and in many ways the story is so, reflective of many of the current, if you like, breaches of trust that have happened with Brexit, with the Northern Ireland protocols. And yes, it's a story of its time, but it resonates, you know, it resonates in the way that on so many occasions,
And this must have been a big story in your family, Stephen.
It was a huge story. And actually, the interesting thing is that Paul's dad, my grandfather, Sarsfield Hogan, was a very kind of senior civil servant. He was the number 2 at the Department of Finance, really, and it was a sure thing that he would have become, you know, the Secretary of the Department of Finance. But 3 months later, after the theft, he didn't get the gig, and it was always thought that the incident with Paul somehow reflected badly and affected. Was one of the reasons why Sarsfield didn't get it. Now, the upshot of this is that the person who did get it, TK Whitaker, did completely reimagine, you know, the Irish economic model and ended protectionism and, you know, really set about creating the modern Irish economy.
That is a very, very good final twist to a very twisty story. That is so fascinating. I really... And I know that this a story was told in this quintessentially Irish documentary, and no less a luminary than Pierce Brosnan is on the case now. I think just one sec, we'll have a listen to Pierce, I think, what he says.
Yeah,
really, okay. Enough is enough now. Bring them back home. It would be rude not to. I'll have to put my thinking hat on here, you know, Thomas Crown, too.
It would be rude not to.
It would be rude not to. Good old Pierce. Yeah, he's... He's great. And, you know, interestingly, I'm part of, we're developing myself and a terrific director and producer developing this as a potential film. And we would love Pierce to be in it and to play McGrath, actually. And we could maybe make him from Navan instead of Dublin. Because
if Pierce is listening, Pierce, the casting director is waiting for your call back. And we have asked the Tate in London if they're going to give them back, but we haven't had any answer from them yet. Stephen, thank you so much. That was a fascinating, fascinating story. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And let me bring in Paddy now. Paddy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. Good afternoon.
Okay, it turns out we've more than one Elgin marble to be worrying about.
I would think so, yeah. I think it's up there somewhere at that level, yeah.
Okay, so what do you think we need to get back?
Now, the item is an item called the Blessington Loon Ula. Loon Ula. And that's sort of a flat-shaped crescent of beaten gold, highly decorated, highly incised. And that dates back, that was found somewhere in the late 19th century and acquired by the British Museum back in 1909.
So was it found in Blessington, Paddy? Was it found in Blessington?
Absolutely, yeah. Found just on the outskirts of the town. And it would date from the late Neolithic to the early Bronze Age. So that means it could be as old as maybe 2,500 before Christ.
And how did it end up?
It's absolutely beautiful.
How did it end up in the British Museum?
Broadly, now I don't have every detail of this. I would have liked to have researched it a bit more. But broadly, a Reverend William Greenwell acquired it in some way back in the late 19th century. And he sold it to the famous financier J.P. Morgan for about £10,000, I think. And that would be about £1 million in today's terms, at least. And then J.P. Morgan donated it in 1909 to the British Museum. He was very wealthy. He was one of the most wealthiest men in the world. So he didn't have to sell it to anybody. He was wealthy enough to be able to donate it to the British Museum.
I'm just looking at a photograph of it. It is absolutely beautiful, isn't it? It is.
It's up there.
Really...
It's up there with Arda Chalice. It's sort of up around that level or somewhere, I would imagine. Now, I'm not an expert in these things, but it's gorgeous.
It is really special.
Yeah.
I hadn't come across this before. It really is.
Yeah, it really is. And I hadn't either, Katie. And next time I'm in London, I've been there a good few times with family stuff last few years. Next time I'm beating my way straight to the British Museum to see that up close.
So why don't we have it?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I think it's a strange question in the sense that most of the items in the British Museum, they're not even British by reference to the time that was in it. You know that they come from all over the world. And, of course, this one comes from just outside Blessington, County Wicklow, Ireland.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's the secret's in the name there. It is the Blessington Lunula. Is that Lunula?
I think it's pronounced L-U-N-U-L-A, and I think you pronounce the U's as Lunula. Yeah, I think so.
I presume that they wouldn't be entertaining any inquiry about why this isn't here, because, as you say, a lot of their artefacts did not originate from Britain. So,
They're from all over the world.
If they started being claimed by us, they would be inundated with demands.
Yeah, though there is a bit of a move afoot recently. I think that some things, I can't be precise on specifics, I think some things have been returned in the same way that artefacts were returned recently from Trinity College to the Aran Islands, I think.
Yes.
So things are going back home gradually. So maybe, who knows?
Well, honestly, it would be very welcome. It would be a huge draw, I think, if we had that on show in any museum.
That would be National Museum. Absolutely. Huge. Yeah.
I'm delighted you brought our attention to that, Paddy. It's a beautiful object.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll take our last break now, and we'll have more demands for more artefacts that they have belonged to us. After
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
John Marr, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
You are a traditional Irish herbalist.
Yep, I am. And my interest is with these manuscripts, with ancient manuscripts, and in particular old herbal manuscripts. You know that these are kept in the British museums and universities, and be great if they could be returned to Ireland. My big fear with them is that because they were written in old Irish Gaelic, I do believe there's very few scholars left that can actually translate these, and it would be such a pity that they would be lost forever.
And what do we know about them? I mean, obviously there's more than one of them. And how do...
Well, see, we probably don't know how many there are, but I could just reference one that was translated in Ireland about 25, 30 years ago. It's based on a manuscript, the Materia Medica of a Tycho Quinn. He was an ancient Irish herbalist, and this he completed this book in 1415. So, you know, that's 600 years ago, if we kind of think about it. A lot of people in Ireland and probably in Europe think that herbal medicine is all about Culpeper and these guys. But, I mean, this is 600 years ago. This book was completed, and the reason I'm just bringing this book up is I look after the St. Anne's Physic Garden, which is in Dublin. It's originally was a joint project between Dublin City Council and the Irish Register of Herbalists. So we'd have over 200 different medicinal herbs growing there.
This is in Raheny.
In Raheny, yeah. So it's within the walled garden. It's a pretty unique. It's a physic garden. It's St. Anne's Physic Garden. So we have a big poster about Tycho Quinn there. You know, it gets a lot of interest. A lot of people are fascinated and think that this was actually wrote in 1415.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's lots of other stuff out there. I really worry that the old manuscripts, there would be no one left to translate them, because it's very time-consuming and to translate. You know, there's very few can do it.
And with the translation comes actual recipes that we might not know, actual herbal cures.
Well, it's not about cures, really. It's what plants they used and why they used them. So we've put up, say, in the garden, we have a small bed with 15, just 15 of the 200 and something herbs that Tycho Quinn used. And so he would have looked after, say, a chieftain or something like that. So their job was to keep the chieftains well, you know, the physician, that was his job, you know. So we still use those herbs today. They're still in use. It's really the knowledge, Katie, that would be lost. And it's not just herbal books. And there's lots of other manuscripts that are you know,
belonging to us, and they won't give back.
Correct.
Is what you're saying, really, John.
Yeah, okay. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Stephen, thanks for that, John. Just one last word to Stephen. I mean, it's an extraordinary movement that your uncle actually started.
Yeah, I think so. And it's unresolved, you know. I mean, okay, the people can see the pictures, but, you know, they should all be back in Dublin in the space where they were intended to be. And I think it's a matter of great pride that Hugh Lane set up this, you know, extraordinary collection dedicated to Ireland. And I think it would be a great gesture on Britain's part. It would be an easy route for a quick win in terms of PR relations, now more so than ever. And the claim still stands, and it's up for it's a 10-year agreement. This last agreement was made in 2021, and it's up for negotiation in 2034.
Stephen, we leave it there. Thanks for that. We'll see if we get any more thoughts on that. Some texters also talking about the Enniscorthy brooch we need to get back, the Scattery Island bell shrine, and my two favourites, Declan Rice and Jack Grealish. That's it. On Sound today, we had Dave Gibson. Our broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. Research was by Richie Byrne, and today's programme was produced by Owen McLaughlin. Stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815. Stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.